Life's better with American Family Insurance because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
You are listening to The Evidence Locker. Our cases have been researched using open source and archive materials. It deals with true crimes and real people. Each episode is produced with the utmost respect to the victims, their families, and loved ones. Warning. This episode deals, in part, with the death of a child. Listener discretion is advised. It was a cool Wednesday morning in the peaceful New Zealand city of Palmerston North in August 2000. Around 9 a.m., Glenn Weggery arrived at his sister Christine's house, where she lived with her husband, Mark Lundy, and their daughter, Amber. Glenn was a self-employed truck driver, and Christine always helped out with the business side of things. 2 days before, on the Monday, Glenn left his checkbook with Christine so she could do his tax return, which was due at the end of the month. Glenn dropped by the following morning, but Christine wasn't done yet and told him to come back on the Wednesday. Glenn regularly visited the Lundy home, but nothing could prepare him for what awaited him on that Wednesday morning of August 30th, 2000. When he arrived, no one answered the door. He waited a while and knocked on the door, this time louder and more urgently. There was still no answer. This was very unusual. Christine was always home at that time. Glenn felt uneasy. Something was not right. So he forced his way into his sister's home. As he walked into the house, he called out to Christine. He was making his way through the living room and froze when he saw his 7-year-old niece. She was lying on the floor in the doorway of the master bedroom. Her blood-soaked hair covered her face, and her head was in an unusual position. Glenn immediately knew from this horrific scene that Amber was no longer alive. He called for help straight away. As he waited for emergency services to arrive, he cautiously made his way to the master bedroom. His worst fear was realized when he found his 38-year-old sister's body on the bed. She was naked, lying face up, drenched with blood. What happened to this mother and daughter in the late August night at 30 Karamea Crescent in the quiet neighborhood in Palmerston North? In August 2000, 43-year-old Mark Lundy and his wife Christine had been married for 18 years. They met at Scouts when they were younger. Christine was still involved in Scouts, helping out with their daughter, Amber's Girl Guides group. The family lived in the provincial city of Palmerston North, which in 2000 had just shy of 80,000 residents. This city is in New Zealand's lower North Island, set in the scenic Manawatu region. Palmerston North is a friendly city, known affectionately as Palmy by the locals. It's a safe and wholesome place to live, and it's considered to be a great city for raising kids, as there are many good schools around. After Mark and Christine had Amber, they struggled to fall pregnant again. They opted not to try IVF treatment and resigned themselves to the fact they would only have one child. Christine was a devoted mother who was very involved in Amber's life. Amber loved to dance, was bubbly, and had many friends. She was known as a strong-willed child, perhaps even a little spoiled. But teachers agreed that it was a pleasure to have her in their class. Mother and daughter would walk home from school, always chatting about what happened in their respective days. Mark Lundy started out as a builder in the 1980s. But later on, Mark and Christine began their own business, selling kitchen sinks and benchtops from their online catalog. It was the type of business they could run from home, so it was nice for Christine to be able to spend time with Amber. Christine looked after the accounts and administration side of things, while Mark was effectively the traveling salesman. He always had samples in his car and traveled to clients all over the North Island to maintain relationships and hopefully make more sales. He routinely traveled to Wellington every second week and always stayed at the same hotel in Petone. Mark was a heavy drinker who liked to boast about himself. This didn't always make him very popular in social circles. But Christine put up with his drinking and his manner, and in later years, their relationship was more of a partnership than a romantic one. In 1999, Mark bought two plots of land next to each other in Hawke's Bay. He had always dreamed of owning his own vineyard, and this was his chance. But the dream had a $2 million price tag. It was perhaps a bit out of his reach, but he was optimistic that he would be able to get money together for the purchase. On Tuesday morning, August 29th, the day before Christine and Amber's murders, Mark accompanied Christine to a lighting shop near their home in Palmerston North to look for a light shade. After they had chosen one, Mark kissed Christine goodbye as she went to pay and he carried on to work. It was around 9:15 in the morning when Mark left for Wellington in his dark blue Ford Fairmont. After meeting with clients in Wellington all day, Mark bought himself a bottle of rum, a Diet Coke, and some food. At 5 p.m., he checked into his usual motel in Petone, the Foreshore Motor Inn. Shortly after 5:30, Christine and Amber called Mark and told him that Amber's Pippins, or Girl Guide, meeting was canceled for the afternoon. Amber spoke to her dad and asked him if she could have McDonald's for dinner. After Mark gave the green light to buy takeaways, Amber passed the phone to her mom. Mark filled Christine in about his meetings that day, and the pair talked about odds and ends regarding their kitchen sink business. The call ended at 5:43, and a receipt shows that mother and daughter purchased their takeaway dinner at 5:45 at the McDonald's in Rangitiki Street, approximately 10 minutes' drive from their home. Little did they know that this would be their last meal. Christine and Amber settled in front of the television and tucked into their chicken burger, fish burger, nuggets, fries, and apple pies. Christine poured each of them a glass of Pepsi Max. At 6:56, the phone rang. It was a woman from the Manawatu Wine Club who called to ask if Mark would be able to help with a wine tasting that week. Christine said that Mark wasn't home and would be back in town the following day. The woman said that the call only lasted about 17 seconds and that Christine was unusually short with her in their brief conversation.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then, Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now, Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Back in Petone, Mark Lundy returned a missed call from a business partner regarding his Hawke's Bay winemaking venture around 8:30 p.m. after missing the initial call 15 minutes earlier. His business partner had called to warn him that an angry creditor was demanding immediate payment. Lundy was upset, disappointed. According to the partner, there was a feeling that it had come to an end. I felt that he had run out of puff trying to make it work. About 3 hours later, Mark Lundy called the Quarry Inn massage parlor and ordered a prostitute from his motel room. A girl who called herself Belinda arrived at 11:45 p.m. She had sex with Lundy and then gave him a massage. At 23 minutes to 1, Belinda took her $140 and left Lundy's motel room. At 7 a.m., Lundy went to the motel manager and asked for batteries for his electric shaver. He checked out earlier than he had done on previous occasions. He would usually hang around for a chat until 9 a.m., but on this particular morning, he checked out promptly at 8. Cell phone records show that Lundy made several phone calls to his home that morning, leaving messages for Christine. Eventually, someone answered, but it wasn't his wife. A friend of Christine's picked up the phone and told him they were a bit busy, but that she would ask Christine to call him back. Back in Palmerston North, shortly after Christine's brother had discovered the gruesome murder scene, Christine's friend, Karen Keegan, arrived to meet Christine for a walk, something that they did 3 times a week. She waited with Glenn for emergency services to arrive. When Mark Lundy called his home, Karen was in the Lundy kitchen, being interviewed by a police constable. The constable instructed her what to say, and she told Mark that his wife would call him back. This was between 9:30 and 10 a.m. Just before midday, Mark Lundy called a friend and said he could not reach Christine, and he asked if he could go to his home and check on her. Minutes later, his friend called back, telling him that there was trouble at his house. Police had cordoned off the property and the street. There was also a report on a local radio station about a suspicious murder. Mark Lundy was in Johnsonville at the time, just north of Wellington. On hearing the news about police at his home in Palmerston North, he immediately got into his car and sped home. On the way, he took a call from a client who he called Lundy being emotional. According to the client, Lundy said that something had happened to his wife and child and that he was headed home. 1 hour and 23 minutes later, at 1:15 p.m., Mark Lundy arrived home in Palmerston North. He was stopped by police about a block away from his house. They had questions for him. He was asked about his whereabouts the night before. They also searched him and his car to see if there was anything that would tie him as the closest relative to this horrific crime. Lundy was dumbfounded, paralyzed with shock, and struck down by grief when he heard about the murders. His reaction was so severe that his friends were concerned that he was not going to be able to deal with the situation. Later that afternoon, Amber's little 7-year-old body was removed from the home, but Christine's body stayed overnight as forensic technicians worked around the clock to gather as much evidence as possible. When she was removed the next day, they took her body through the bedroom window so as to preserve any evidence in the rest of the house. In the conservatory at the back of the house, it was evident that one of the windows had been pried open. The window frame had Christine's blood on it, which meant that it was broken after the murders had been committed. The blood was from a print made by someone wearing gloves. It was clear that the intruder tried to stage a robbery, also taking Christine's jewelry box with them. But that was the only missing item. In the house were computers and other valuables, and Christine's car remained untouched. Christine's computer in the study was shut down for the last time at 10:52 p.m. However, that doesn't mean Christine was the last person to use it. Police also believed someone could have reset the clock on her computer after the murders. In the master bedroom, there was blood splatter all over the walls and floor. Pathologist Dr. James Pang concluded that the murder weapon must have been a tomahawk-like blade or an axe. But despite extensive searches of the area, neither the stolen jewelry box nor the murder weapon was ever found. Christine and Amber Lundy's funeral was held on September 7, 2000, at St. Peter's Anglican Church. It was televised nationally, and scenes of Mark Lundy almost collapsing with grief gripped the nation's attention. He needed people by his side to prop him up in order to make it through the proceedings. The autopsy results found that a 7-year-old Amber had been struck 7 times. Both victims had multiple injuries to their faces and heads. But the attack on Christine Lundy had been far more severe. She was struck 18 times in the head and face with a tomahawk. One wound was 3 inches or 8 centimeters deep. Her assailant dealt so many vicious blows that the headboard behind her was also damaged. Christine also had bruising, incisions, and fractures on her arms and hands, signs that she desperately tried to defend herself against her assailant. By analyzing the victim's stomach contents, Dr. Peng was able to conclude Christine and Amber's time of death. Their stomachs were still full, with no obvious signs of digestion and no obvious smell of gastric juices, making the time of the murder around 1 hour after ingestion. This means, if they ate soon after arriving home at 6 p.m., the time of death would have been around 7. Police were suspicious of Mark Lundy from the start of this investigation. Lundy's friend who informed him about the unfolding drama at his home on the morning of August the 30th mentioned to him that he had heard a news report about a suspicious murder. He did not say murders. Yet when Lundy spoke with a client minutes later, he said that he was heading home as something had happened to his wife and his daughter. During the autopsy, blue and orange flakes of paint were found on Christine's skull. When Lundy was a builder, he used blue and orange paint to mark his tools so he could identify them when working on site. The paint fragments were found to be the exact same color, and it had the same chemical composition. Though that didn't prove that Mark Lundy was the one who killed his wife and daughter, the tools were stored in a garage at the Lundy home. The garage was found to be locked on the morning of the 30th when Christine and Amber's bodies were found. Police focused their attention on the seemingly grieving husband. A week after the murders, Margaret Dance, a 60-year-old neighbor, came forward. She said that she saw a man running near her house at 7:15 p.m. She was driving to her choir practice. The man had a blonde curly wig that was slipping down over his forehead. The disguise was supposed to make him look like a woman. When she saw Mark Lundy on TV, she recognized him as the runner, based on the shape of his face and upper body. But on the night of his family's murder, Mark Lundy was 93 miles, 150 kilometers, away. Was it possible that he could have driven back to Palmerston North, murdered his wife and daughter at 7 p.m., then sped back to Petone where he returned his business partner's phone call at 8:29 p.m.? According to police, Mark Lundy's motive for killing his wife Christine was for the life insurance money, and because Amber witnessed what he had done, he had to kill her too. Police looked into Lundy's vineyard deal. He had promised a deposit of $10,000, after which he could not pull out of the deal anymore. Money for one of the pockets of land was due at the end of February 2000. But August rolled around, and yet no final payment had ever been made. The vendor gave Lundy an ultimatum. He had until the end of August to pay, or the deal would be off. Lundy admitted in a statement that 2 months before the murders, he was advised by an insurance representative to increase cover on his and Christine's lives to $1 million each. But because of health issues, like blood pressure and cholesterol, they only increased each policy from $200,000 to $500,000. The whole theory of Lundy's guilt had many problems. Firstly, it normally takes just shy of 2 hours to drive from Petone to Palmerston North. Lundy checked into the motel at 5:30, then finished the phone call to his wife and daughter 15 minutes later. This means he would have been stuck in rush hour traffic for most of the way, had he left straight away. There was no way he could have made it back in time to make the phone call to his business partner at 8:29, as cell phone towers proved that he was in Petone at the time of the call. Then there was the fuel issue. When Lundy arrived home from Wellington on the day that Christine and Amber's bodies were found, police examined his car. The Ford's 68-liter tank was not big enough to make 2 round trips between Palmerston North and Petone in Wellington. There was no evidence that Lundy had stopped for fuel. He was pedantic about keeping fuel receipts, seeing as he could claim it as a business expense. Theories emerged that Lundy filled a jerry can prior to the night of the murders and filled up the car without leaving any trace. To refuel his car with a jerry can without being seen and running 500 meters to his own neighborhood wearing a wig would be pushing it for a man of Mark Lundy's build. He also wore an orthotic aid in his shoe, which made it difficult for him to run. Changing the clock of the family computer would require someone who was confident with computers. The theory was perhaps possible, at a stretch. But it all seemed very sophisticated for someone who seemed just like a simple family man. Yes, maybe overweight. Yes, he may have overplayed his grief at his wife and daughter's funeral. And yes, he did cheat on his wife with a prostitute. This all makes him a very unlikable man. But does it make him a murderer? Police felt that it did. In February 2001, 6 months after the brutal attack, Mark Edward Lundy was arrested and charged with Christine's and Amber's murders. The trial began 1 year later at Palmerston North High Court. Lundy pleaded not guilty to the charges. The Crown, or prosecution, stated their case. Lundy had rushed home after speaking to his wife and daughter, murdered them at 7 p.m., and then returned to Wellington before 8:30 p.m., where cell phone pings confirmed he made the call to his business partner. It was a circumstantial case, and not a very good one at that. Experts tried to replicate the drive, but nobody was able to do it in the time frame alleged by the Crown. Private investigator Paul Bass said, "I just don't know how he was able to make the trip as alleged. Without people being on their cell phones pushing star 555, because you would have to be driving like an absolute lunatic, and you are going to bring an awful lot of attention to yourself. If your focus is to go and do something discreetly and give yourself an alibi, it doesn't make sense that you would then draw attention to yourself." The star 555 number that Bass mentioned is the number for Road Watch. It's the number you dial in New Zealand to report a road incident or an unsafe driver. To explain why Christine was found in the nude, prosecution argued that Lundy had told her he was coming home for sex. She sent Amber to bed much earlier than usual and waited for her husband to arrive. And when he did, he killed her. The case against Mark Lundy needed concrete evidence. This came from the shirt Lundy was wearing on the night his family was murdered. A small speck of human tissue was found on the front pocket of his polo shirt. The DNA matched Christine's. Investigators looked worldwide to find anyone who would be willing to test such a small sample. When Rodney Miller, director of immunohistochemistry at a company called ProPath in Dallas, Texas, heard from the lead investigator, Ross Grantham, he agreed to test the sample. And what he found shocked everyone in court. The tissue from Mark Lundy's shirt came from Christine's brain. Rodney Miller flew over to New Zealand and testified that he was 100% sure that the sample was from either brain tissue or spinal cord fluid. He confirmed that one could not get that type of sample from a superficial cut. It was the first time a process called immune staining had ever been used on fabric. Queen's counsel Philip Morgan's statement summed up the evidence. "No man should have his wife's brain on his shirt." At that moment, the atmosphere in court changed. Everybody present felt that despite many questions, Mark Lundy had to be the axe murderer who killed his wife and young daughter. Police believed that Lundy wore coveralls during the attack, coveralls that were never found. The brain matter could have smudged onto the left chest pocket from his hand or glove when he removed the coverall. Miller's tests have been criticized and called experimental. The preservation of the tissue sample was brought into question. The lack of necessary controls was also alarming. Also, why was there brain or spinal cord tissue on the shirt, but no blood? It was a vicious and bloody attack. There was no way that a minute but pure speck of brain tissue would make its way onto the perpetrator's shirt, and yet not one drop of blood could be detected. There was no blood on Lundy's clothes, glasses, or in his car. Lundy's shirt also showed no signs of sweat. Surely, after wielding an axe for more than 20 blows and running away, wearing a wig, a person would at least sweat a little bit. Lundy's defense argued that the sample was contaminated by forensic examiners. They also accused lead investigator Grantham of tampering with evidence, saying he did so to frame Lundy for the murders. But the jury didn't buy it. The phrase was just too powerful. No man should have his wife's brain on his shirt. When Lundy took the stand, he did more damage to his own case. He contradicted previous statements and even disputed evidence given by his own brother. A friend also stated that Lundy usually called home when he was traveling to say goodnight to Amber, around 8 p.m. Lundy definitively denied that this was something he usually did. A large part of Lundy's questioning focused on the call Lundy missed at 8:15 p.m. on the night of the murders. Why did it take him 15 minutes to return the call? Lundy said he was on the toilet when he heard his phone ring. When he was done, he got stuck into his book before he remembered there was a missed call. The defense made the point that Lundy did not know that he would receive a phone call from his business associate that night. If he had killed Christine and Amber around 7 p.m., he had all night to make his way back to Petone. Why chase back if he could simply have driven at normal pace? There was no way he could have known his partner would call at 8:15 p.m. It was not an alibi that he had set up. A crowd of more than 60 of Christine's and Amber's friends and family kept a vigil at the court, praying for justice. The jury did not find Lundy believable. They took less than 7 hours to return a guilty verdict. Mark Lundy was sentenced to life imprisonment with a minimum non-parole period of 17 years. A couple of months following Lundy's sentencing, a man who worked at the Petone Working Men's Club came forward and said that he had seen Mark Lundy sitting on the foreshore reading a book after dusk on the night of August 29, 2000. It's only after he saw Lundy's trial on TV that he realized his information could have been relevant. That same year, Lundy appealed his conviction, but his appeal was rejected and the court increased his non-parole period to 20 years. Lundy served 11 years in prison before taking his next legal step. In New Zealand, since 2004, the last resort for appeals is currently the Supreme Court. But because the crime and sentencing occurred before then, he could still appeal to the Privy Council in Britain. This is the highest court of appeal in certain British territories, as New Zealand used to be prior to 2004. It paid off. In October 2013, the Privy Council quashed Lundy's convictions and ordered a retrial. The retrial was held at the High Court in Wellington. The Crown, or prosecution, came prepared. They argued that the initial timeline of the night of Christine and Amber's murders was wrong in the initial case. The new theory was that Lundy left Petone after midnight. With this new theory, many of the holes in the previous theory were closed up, and it seemed more plausible that Lundy, after his interlude with the prostitute, drove home, killed his family, and drove back. He had time between the hours of 1 a.m. and 7 a.m. to make the highly discussed trip from Petone to Palmerston North and back. This was possible. The Crown also argued that the initial time of death was incorrect. Digestion is not a very reliable source for determining a time of death. In his original statement, Dr. Peng said that there was no gastric smell present, concluding that digestion had not started. Professor Derek Pounder, head of the Center for Forensic and Legal Medicine at Dundee University in Scotland, a recognized international expert in this field, stated, "There is, to my knowledge, no scientific literature with respect to stomach content smell and time of death, and the comment on this matter is incomprehensible to me." Experts consulted in this case agree that most people's stomach contents empty within 2 to 10 hours. But there are many factors to consider when looking at digestion. For instance, if the victims were in distress or if they had consumed liquids with their meal, digestion would take longer. Digestion would only start once 80% of the liquid had emptied out of the stomach. At the Lundy home was an empty 1-liter bottle of Pepsi Max and 2 empty glasses with Christine and Amber's DNA on them. It is fair to assume they had Pepsi with their takeaways. If digestion took, let's say, 8 hours to start, that would shift the time of death to 2 a.m. There is also the possibility that Christine had a bite before she went to bed. It is not conclusive exactly when all the food was eaten. Mystery still surrounded the fact that Christine usually went to bed at 11 p.m. So why, then, would she have been naked in bed at 7 p.m.? The idea that Lundy had called and said he was on his way to have sex did not make sense. It had been established that the couple didn't have much of a romantic life. Such a request would be completely out of the ordinary. Christine liked to read Mills and Boone's novels before she went to sleep. She used reading glasses and would put them in her case before she went to sleep. When she was found, the glasses were in the case and the bedside lamp was off. The assumption being that she was asleep before she was attacked. And with her normal bedtime being closer to 11 p.m., the theory that she was killed at 7 p.m. would be implausible. Also, Christine and Amber habitually watched a local Channel 2 soap opera called Shortland Street, which started at 7 p.m. and finished at 7:30 p.m. Amber loved the show too, and would usually get her way. If Christine had said they weren't watching Shortland Street, Amber would have kicked up a fight. Family and friends gave evidence and stated that they felt Amber would not have been in full pajamas, in bed, and miss her TV show at 7 p.m. Her usual bedtime was 8 p.m. At the crime scene, the TV was on standby, switched off with a remote control. The channel was set on Channel 4, not Channel 2. The last TV show Christine watched was not Shortland Street, but something on Prime. In the kitchen were signs that Christine baked at some point during the night. On the bench was a banana peel, and in the sink, some baking tins. The computer at the Lundy home was shut down at 10:52 p.m. Christine was known to do the accounts for their business at night after Amber had gone to sleep. Remember, at the first trial, they argued that Mark had reset the time on the computer. And although it's possible, it doesn't seem plausible for a guy like Mark, who was not very much of a tech person, to change the time. Christine was by far the more computer literate of the couple, and the one who mostly worked on that computer for their business. Mark and Christine also owned a laptop that Mark occasionally took with them on business trips. On the night of her death, Christine was doing her brother Glenn Wegery's taxes. Only the laptop, not the PC, had the necessary accounting software on that she used. On the morning of Wednesday, August 30th, the laptop was found in the study, in its case, resting on a chair next to an open space on the desk. A space where it appears that the laptop had been before it was packed away into its case. Christine had also finished her brother's tax return as promised. It was ready and waiting on the kitchen bench. She must have done the return sometime between Tuesday morning and going to bed on Tuesday night. Unfortunately, the laptop was never properly searched. In fact, there seems to be some ambiguity as to who searched the computer and if it was ever clocked as evidence. Sometime after the crime, Lundy updated software on the laptop, which caused it to crash. That means that evidence from August 29th was lost forever, and police were unable to retrieve any further evidence. With the latest medical evidence now pointing towards a later time of death, it was now plausible that Mark Lundy could have driven home in the dead of night. There would have been few witnesses, and of course, hardly any traffic. The Crown painted a picture of a desperate, greedy man who killed his wife for life insurance money so he could realize his dream of owning his very own vineyard. The only flaw in the plan was the witness, his own daughter. Mark Lundy did what he had to do and killed his 7-year-old daughter as well. He then staged a burglary, disposed of the murder weapon and the coveralls he was wearing, and drove back to Petone. If he left Petone at 1 a.m., that would give him 6 hours to drive the return trip, commit the murders, and be back at 7 a.m. when he asked the motel manager for batteries for his electric shaver. Mark Lundy's defense fought back. They agreed that the time of death was probably not earlier, but later. They used this fact to show that the Crown's original case had many mistakes, like witness statements, for instance. Although police felt that Margaret Dance, the neighbor who saw a man with a blonde wig, was believable, Lundy's defense tried their best to attack her credibility. They presented a review she wrote for an eye clinic in a local newspaper in 2007. It says, "Thank you from the bottom of my heart for the vision I have not had for over 60 years, in spite of now being able to see my wrinkles and cobwebs in the house." 60 years of bad vision? Yet she was able to testify that she saw Lundy running in a wig on the night of the murder. Defense did not find this testimony very credible. Another neighbor's evidence that didn't fit into the original timeline was that of Tupe Tupa. He was He was standing outside his house on the night of August 29th, talking to his dad in Samoa on his phone. He said that the lights at the back of the Lundy house were on. Cell phone records show that Tupe's call was at 10:56 p.m. and lasted for about 10 minutes. The next morning, first responders noted that all lights in the house were off. The most damning evidence in the first case was without a doubt the issue of Christine's brain tissue on Lundy's shirt. His defense team set out to prove that the sample did not come from a human, but from a chili beef and cheese pie that Lundy had eaten the night before. The Crown had Dutch scientist Dr. Letitia Sijen test the sample for RNA. RNA is similar to DNA, but where DNA cannot tell you what the tissue is, but instead who it comes from, RNA can tell where on the body the sample comes from. The tests only concluded that the sample had a bigger chance of being from a human than from an animal. It was not 100% conclusive. Mark Lundy's defense wanted this evidence thrown out, but they did not succeed. After a 7-week trial and about 16 hours of deliberation, on April 1, 2015, the jury found Mark Lundy guilty yet again. Despite this, Lundy maintained his innocence. As he refused to admit guilt, he would never be eligible for parole. In 2009, a couple of years before the second trial, journalist Mark White wrote an investigative article for the magazine North and South. In the article, Lundy Murders, What the Jury Didn't Hear, he unearths evidence that raised questions about Lundy's first conviction. The article also debunks the original 7 p.m. time of death theory. Christine was a creature of habit, and the chances of her and Amber being asleep in bed at 7 p.m. were highly unlikely. Also, back in Petone, two motel guests recalled seeing a blue Ford Fairmont parked between 6 and 7 p.m. at the Foreshore Motor Inn where Lundy was staying on August 29th, again breaking down the original theory. Margaret Dance's testimony that she saw Lundy on the night was not airtight. She also mentioned that the car the person was running to was parked in front of her house. Another neighbor said there was a bluish car parked, yes, but it was a smaller Ford, like a Fiesta, and an older model. Not the larger Ford Fairmont sedan that Lundy owned. The car in question was parked across the road from a friend of Lundy's house, under a streetlight. Would he have taken the chance of parking where he or his car could easily be identified close to his home? The article also questions the forensic evidence. Firstly, there is a question about the paint fragments found on Christine's skull that matched paint from Mark Lundy's tools. In all, there were 47 fragments. Is it possible for so many fragments to come off a tomahawk during an attack? Forensic agency, ESR, tested Lundy's other tools that were marked with blue and orange paint. They knocked them against the hard surface multiple times, but no flakes came off. Also, out of 18 paint fragments from Christine's skull, forensic scientists noted 16 were contaminated. Questions were also raised around Lundy's shirt with the alleged brain matter. If Lundy had planned this murder and managed to dispose of the murder weapon and the alleged coveralls, why would he leave his incriminating shirt in the car? With no blood on any of his clothes or anywhere in his car, Lundy had to have worn coveralls. But where was the proof? There was no receipt or witnesses who could support the fact that Lundy ever owned coveralls. There was even more unexplained evidence at the crime scene that was never mentioned during the first trial. Lundy's appeal lawyer, Jonathan Eaton, claimed that in the conservatory with the broken window hatch, an unidentified footprint was found. And even more damning, there was unidentified DNA found, as well as an unidentified fiber. The fiber which did not match Lundy's much-discussed polo shirt. Unidentified hairs were found in Christine Lundy's clenched hands. There were also 7 fingerprints at the crime scene that had never been identified. Lundy's motive of killing for insurance money was also brought under the spotlight. Firstly, the increased insurance policies weren't taken out at Mark Lundy's request. In fact, the Lundys were planning to increase their cover, but they never completed the paperwork. Mark Lundy also did not claim the insurance after Christine's murder. Besides, if he was after the money, he would have committed the murder much earlier in the year, The deadline for payment to the vendor of the vineyard was due 2 days after the murder. There are more questions about Mark Lundy's behavior. Why would he hire a prostitute to serve as an alibi? If he had planned the murder, having a prostitute as an alibi would be risky. It would tarnish his reputation as a loving husband and father. If all he wanted to do was to establish an alibi, why not simply talk to one of the guests at the motel? A number of people have doubts about the conviction of Mark Lundy. A group called Factual Trust, which is an acronym for Amber and Christine, Truth Uncovered About Lundys, was founded to fight for justice in the Lundy case. The aim is to find out, if Mark Lundy is innocent as he claims, who then killed his family. No one deserves to die, but least of all a mother and her young child who is no threat to anyone. There were rumors and theories that emerged in the early days of the investigation. A neighbor of the Lundys vanished soon after the murders. Could it have been an intruder, high on P, a drug like meth, and a home invasion gone wrong? None of these leads ever went anywhere. There was just no concrete evidence to back them up. The bottom line is this. Christine and Amber were most likely killed in the early morning hours of August 30th. The attack on Christine was much worse than the one on young Amber, who was probably only in the wrong place at the wrong time. Mark Lundy is arguably the most hated man in New Zealand. He is seen as an overweight, greedy sleaze who slept with a prostitute hours before killing his well-liked wife and daughter, then faked debilitating grief at their funeral and still refuses to admit guilt. He made contradicting statements and gave inconsistent information about his day in Wellington. He said he met clients earlier than he did, or that he saw them when he didn't. This made him look like a liar. But again, the outcome of a trial should not rest solely on the character of a person. Evidence should be presented and accepted beyond a reasonable doubt. Mark Lundy's defense attorney, Jonathan Eaton, was well aware that his client was not likely to win any popularity contests. He said, "Everyone remembers Mark Lundy's behavior at the funeral. The public perception that he feigned distress has entered New Zealand folklore. He has engendered no public sympathy." Lundy managed to bring his case in front of the Supreme Court in Wellington, appealing his conviction for a second time. The appeal trial started in October 2017. As it stands today, Mark Lundy's appeal lies before three appellate judges, and a decision should be made before 2018 is done. If he is found innocent, his conviction would arguably be one of the biggest cases of wrongful conviction in New Zealand history. Keep an eye on our Facebook page, and we will let you know as soon as there are any updates. If you'd like to read more about this case, have a look at the resources used for this episode in the show notes. You would enjoy the New Zealand documentary, Investigator. Also visit and like our Facebook page at facebook.com/Evidence Locker Podcast to see more about today's case. And if you like our podcast, please subscribe in Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. We would also appreciate if you could review the episodes, as it really does give us some street cred in the world of podcasting. This was The Evidence Locker. Thank you for listening.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.